the Korean War.
Before I talk a little bit about Korea and this film that I've been working on, I want to tell you a little bit how I got to the point where I wanted to do something about Korea. Like many veterans and many people in this country, I grew up in a very typical home in upstate New York. My father was a Fuller brush salesman, going door to door selling brushes to people. I don't think you can do that anymore. It's probably against the law to go soliciting house to house. And I was just enjoyed growing up in my farming community and playing sports and getting through high school and going to college. And I was not particularly interested in going into the military, but I was very much for the Vietnam War. I was very blissed out as a young American, believing in everything my country had told me. I really did believe in everything. It's a fantastic story, actually. Born and raised in a country that's the greatest country in the history of the world, endowed by God to bring justice to the planet. It really gives one a good feeling to know that you're part of that. So I was for the war, but I wasn't particularly interested in me being in the war. So I would prefer to stay in graduate school, where I was at the time, when I got drafted, with a 2S school deferment, which I didn't think could happen. I flew home to upstate New York to meet with my Selective Service Board, thinking a mistake must have been made. And they explained to me why I was drafted from a rural agricultural county where the oldest son, family farms, had an absolute deferment, and my school deferment was only preferential. And the Pentagon did not take into account, when they issued their quotas to different counties, that in an agricultural county, the demographic base was reduced by virtue of all these family farms with sons that had absolute deferments, meaning those that had school deferments were more likely to be called if the quotas started increasing from the Pentagon. So I said, okay, and they deferred my draft to the end of the semester, and I enlisted in an Air Force officer program in the meantime. So, okay, I was in the military. Became a second lieutenant at the end of 1966. Had a plush assignment at Headquarters Air Force until 68 in Washington. And then got this very unusual assignment to go to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, to an Army base, learn Ranger training for 12 weeks as an Air Force officer in order to go to Vietnam with 40 men to protect air bases where we might do patrols out 500 meters from the perimeter of the base. Not as bad as being a Marine or being Army search and destroy missions, but I wasn't really happy about the assignment. But there was something that happened in that 12 weeks that was a clue that maybe I had something else percolating in me that I wasn't really aware of until the bayonet training. And during bayonet training, we were supposed to shout, "Kill," 100 times as we plunged the bayonet into these dummies in front of us. And I paused for a moment as the other 20 officers proceeded to plunge their bayonets into the dummy, shouting "kill" as loud as they could. And there was something about the whole notion that I was resisting, but I did want to do it. I did not want to be different. I did not want to not do it. So I hesitated just long enough that the sergeant that was training us in this bayonet drill came up and shouted in my ear, "Did you hear that order?" I said, "Yes, sir." And I was fully prepared to begin the plunging of my bayonet into the dummy, and I paused a little longer because it obviously was something I was struggling with, and the sergeant then kicked me in the calf, and my legs buckled, and so I was down on the ground on my knees. And I said, "Well, I'm not going to do this drill now." And I didn't do it. And I thought, well, this is going to identify me as a wimp, and I'm going to be identified in some way that's going to give me a problem in the Air Force. Well, actually, nothing happened from that, except that I did explain to our commander that I had a problem thinking I was going to be bayoneting people in Vietnam, and he simply said, well, it's too bad you didn't do the drill because you might have to do hand-to-hand combat in Vietnam and you won't know how to defend yourself. And it was left virtually at that. So after 12 weeks, I was in Vietnam with my men, 40 men. We were flown to Binh Tui Air Base, 100 miles south of Saigon. And as we landed, the base came under mortar attack. And it was like, oh, wow, well, here it is. This is reality. And we recovered from that, but it was a kind of a shocking introduction to landing in Vietnam. And my basic job was to coordinate these 40 men to protect the perimeter of the base. We had heavy machine guns, anti-personnel radar, starlight scopes, and so forth. But what I wasn't prepared for was being asked by the Vietnamese base commander, Colonel An, to do an extra duty with one of his lieutenants to go to bombing mission sites and assess the success or failure of the pilots in their bombing mission. I had a Jeep that worked. Colonel An's, one of his Jeeps had been blown up. He had a nice Jeep. He didn't want to go out and to this mission. So I think I was selected because I had a Jeep that worked. And I went with one of his lieutenants who knew the roads. And we went in April of 1969 to the first village we were asked to go to. It was about 11 o'clock in the morning. It was very hot, as every day was, probably 115, 117 degrees. And first thing we saw when we got to this village, the lieutenant said, stop here. We got out of the Jeep. There was smoke coming up from many sources on the ground. And I heard to my right a loud roar, and I saw there was a water buffalo that had been hit with shrapnel and a big 3-foot gash in his belly. And then I looked to the left, and I saw just a sea of bodies. And probably 100 to 120 corpses. Few of them were moving. Most of them were still. This was 15 minutes after the bombing. I looked down as I was slowly taking steps in my first seconds of shock. And I realized I was about to step on a young woman with three children. She was clutching three children. And I was kind of, it was just kind of a shocking experience to see this. And I looked at her face, which was recognizable just barely, but I noticed that her eyes were open. And I looked at her eyes, kind of in some, almost some kind of a trance, a shock trance or something, as I was looking at her face thinking she's alive. And then I realized the napalm had burned the skin off her face, burned her eyelids off. The children had been all hit with serious shrapnel and napalm. And I started throwing up. And then I started weeping. And this lieutenant, who was 3 feet to my right, witnessing the same scene, asked me what my problem was. Now, he was a Vietnamese lieutenant who'd been educated in Mississippi by the United States military, had come back to Vietnam to serve in the South Vietnamese Air Force, actually. And I told people who heard me earlier today this story, but it's kind of how I can get going because it's what started my life on this track I'm on. I said to this lieutenant, without thinking. It didn't go through an intellectual process that I'm aware of. I simply said, well, this is part of my family. And I don't know where that came from, except maybe a very ancient place in the human psyche that I didn't even know existed. Certainly didn't know I, who was such a straight guy, so blissed out in America, that I would have some sense that maybe we're all connected. Maybe all life is connected in some sacred fabric. But that was a strange concept to me. He laughed and said, "They're communists, this is a victory, come on, let's go." We got in my Jeep and left. We didn't even call in any medical help for the people that might have still been alive that were moaning and moving on the ground. Just leave, it's like not important.